The following podcast on the WDKX Podcast Network is
provided by Vision Automotive.
Welcome back, everybody. We're here at another episode of Moving the Needle. So grateful that you're here today. Today, as we examine the what, the so what, and the now what, the what today is school, rapid school improvement possible? So important a question. We're going to really jump into that thing. I'm excited to be here today. I am Pastor Sebrin Johnson. I'm here with my partner in crime, Paul Miller.
Hey, this is Dr. Paul Miller, the omega, the ending, the all, the that is moving the needle with my partner here, Sebrin. He didn't say the O. I think it's for like Orenthal or something, like Orenthal Johnson, you know, I don't know, whatever his middle name is, or Otis, or I don't know, Oklahoma. What's your middle name, man? The O.
The O stands for, oh my goodness. And so we're grateful to be here today. It's just, it's going to be a good conversation today. He told you I'm the Alpha, he's the Omega. So we have some conflict here and there, but it's all in love. Today in the studio, we have our dear sister in education, Sarah Kastner, CEO of Discovery Charter School. And I'm just wondering the kind of things we're going to get into today. Can you kick it off for us, Dr. Miller?
Hey, we're going to go and dig in today, because a lot of schools in our city and in our country are failing. And so we're kind of curious, is school turnaround possible? So we have somebody who has done the work. Sarah has done the work. We're going to give her some time to shine today. We're going to have some time to talk about herself and just also talk about, you know, the work that she's done. Because if she can do it, why can't that be duplicated? Why can't that model be taken a look at and use that? And so we're going to dig in. Like, Sarah, tell everybody, introduce us. Tell us who you are, what do you do, what's your why, all that good stuff.
Sure. I'm Sarah Kastner, school director at Discovery, like they said. I have been in education since 2000. Before I came to Discovery, I spent 14 years as a special education teacher in the city district, in BOCES, and in a rural district, in one other charter. I've been at Discovery for 11 years, but this is my fifth year as the school director. I started at Discovery as the special education teacher for the building, and that evolved into me being the dean of students, and then special education coordinator, and then assistant director, and now here I am, because 4 years ago, we were in jeopardy of being shut down, and we needed to change. So.
Okay.
What was it like when you heard, Sarah, you're taking the reins now, you have this, in this situation, we only want you to do one thing, turn it around. What went through your mind?
Oh, boy.
The real answer, like that little, like the Hershey squirt that squeezed out a little bit. Like, okay, come on, we're
going to be real. My initial thought was, shit. Okay. I can do this. I had to convince myself a little bit. But always I was committed to Discovery. I've loved Discovery since I walked in the doors. I made connections with kids and families from the beginning. And I think evolving through my roles at Discovery, I got to know people in a different capacity. And I thought, all right, you know what? We can do this. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but we're going to do it because my kids and families deserve it. It was terrifying.
And that takes me, because when you're terrified, you still have to step up as a leader, right? Mm-hmm. And so who are you, first of all, as a person and as a leader? And are they different or are they same, and why? You know, because sometimes those things are different.
I think as a person and as a leader, I'm exactly the same. I'm pretty genuine. I'm compassionate about what I'm compassionate about. I'm respectful and positive. I have super high expectations for people in my personal life as I do in my work life. I think I'm really the same. My values are the same as a leader and as a person. I would say most of all, I'm genuine and dedicated.
So let me ask you this question, and this is going somewhere. What's the racial makeup of Discovery?
Students or staff? I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but I think we have about 80% black or brown students. And then we have a well, I guess everybody fall, the majority of the kids fall into a black or brown category. We have some Arabic-speaking students. We have some Spanish-speaking students. But then we're predominantly black or brown students, for sure.
Wow. So that brings me to something, and I'll make a statement and just comment on this. So 80% black and brown, some other ethnicities mixed in there. They can't see us on the podcast. Dr. Paul Miller pointed this out to me earlier. You're a white woman.
I sure am.
And you are in partnership with others running Discovery Charter School and enjoying enormous success. And it just makes me feel that although it is important how you look to students, it might be more important how students look to you. How do you see the students that you serve? How do you see the students that are striving? How do you see the students that are the next generation of Rochesterians? Talk to me about your thoughts in terms of how you teach each student and how you support each student with those teachers, and they don't look like you.
I think that's one of the highlights of Discovery. We focus on individual student needs. I look at our students as students who need to maybe break a cycle in their life or help their parents break their relationship with education. Maybe that was a bad relationship. I look at our students that they need a safe, supportive, high-quality education that their suburban peers are getting. I think the fact that we look so closely at every student is essential. You could probably name 5 students and I could likely give you their academic data. Because I care about them and I care about their success.
Steve Brown.
No, he doesn't go there. I mean, it's just, it's a little cliche, but they're our future. And I hope that some of my students come back and teach at Discovery. You know, I would love that.
Adding on to that, like, what's your intentionality culturally when you're leading the black and brown students within this Rochester, New York? So what does that look like?
I think it'd be the same across the board. Safe, high-quality education that gives kids opportunities that their peers have in different areas.
And, I'm going to push a little bit. Because So if I was a listener, I'm out there, and I'm like, oh, who's this white lady that is now thinks that she's saving our kids, right? and I don't think that's the case, right? But there's going to be somebody out there listening that's saying that, right? But so culturally, like, how do you create an environment where they feel part of that safety is connecting to their roots? Part of their safety is connecting to and seeing something that they can identify with or learning about things that they can identify with. So how are you intentional in that, especially being of a different race than your students?
So we celebrate all of our students' cultures regularly. I worked really hard when I took over as school director. I think we had about 5% diverse staff at Discovery. And I knew that our kids need to see people who look like them to, you know, feel more successful or safe or just have a role model. And now we have 36% of our staff who look like our students. That was a goal of mine, and it continues to be a goal of mine. I think I forgot the first part of your question.
Well, let me jump in, though, even with that. Because I'm trying to break up some things, some long-accepted principles that may not be true. Because I've heard that data shows kids need rigid structure. They don't do well with change. They don't adapt when things go different. Yet and still, Discovery found themselves in a place where you had to change a lot if you were going to truly educate the children that are there. And so how did the kids really accept that change if it's true that they can't do change?
I would say at Discovery that's not true.
All right.
I had teachers, family saying, our kids can't do this. It's going to be too hard. Those expectations are too high. This is too rigorous. Our kids were ready. They were more than ready. They were excited. Kids need structure. We put structure in place. We didn't have a lot of structure before. kids rose to the occasion. I mean, look what we're doing. We've got 71% of our kids passing the New York State math test. Wow. And I anticipate this last year's scores, when they ever come out, will be higher. Kids do well with structure. And kids are resilient. Change is what it is. I mean, the good news, the majority of the kids knew me, so I wasn't a new face to them. They knew me, respected me. Some of them knew me as the dean. Some of them knew me as their teacher. Some of them knew me as assistant director, depending on their age. And, you know, we all just, we have a mutual respect for each other. I would say probably more than half our families have my cell number, and they can call me at any time. And, you know, maybe I'll go to somebody's house for dinner, or I went to some parent's wedding or a baby shower. Like, I'm more than willing to immerse myself in their culture, because if they don't respect me and trust me, then I'm not going to be able to move them. So that's been essential, I think, in my role, to be able to do that, to build trust with the families.
Absolutely. And I think that's important. What's interesting to me is, what were the school's struggles previously, and what were the most difficult aspects to change, and why? Like, what did those struggles look like? Because the reason why I asked that question is because I want people to be able to identify and say, hey, our schools are going through that as well. And then you also, before I get back to the question, you mentioned that you had a 71% proficiency rate in math currently. And comparatively, I think you started off somewhere, I think if I remember correctly, around 14%.
12%,
right? Mm-hmm. And I think if we go to the Rochester City School District, they're somewhere between 2 and 8%, depending on what discipline or content area it is. And like, that means that 98% of your kids can't read or write or do math.
Wow.
When you're going to the district.
Wow.
Right? So, and but you got to 71%. So there had to be some struggles there. What did those struggles look like, and what aspects were most difficult to change, and why?
Sure. We had a lot of struggles, I'm going to be honest. We struggled behaviorally with students. We struggled academically. We struggled with having the right curriculum. We struggled with systems, routines, lack of diversity among staff. We struggled with staff being prepared. I would say, if you could label every feature of a school that's important, we pretty much struggled with it all. But knowing exactly what to address first, I think, was essential. And culture is first. You have to have a good school culture, because people have to trust the school culture to make movement. So if you've got, you know, classrooms out of control and teachers focusing on, you know, you're a babysitter all day and you're dealing with behaviors all day, which happens a lot in a lot of schools. And it happened a lot at Discovery years ago. You just can't make moves with kids. So culture was huge, changing that around. And within that, the other things fell into place. Quality instruction fell into place, because teachers understood we had higher priorities for our kids. And that was hard for teachers. And the teachers who couldn't handle it left. I mean, if you don't believe our kids can achieve just as any other student, if you don't believe that these targets that the leadership team sets are attainable, then you shouldn't be here. I mean, that's a little harsh, but
it's true.
If you don't have what it takes, then you should hop out, because I don't have time for that. Our kids don't have time for that. They can't afford it.
Wow, strong leadership.
So I think someone said to me in the beginning, like, you need to be cutthroat. And I said, oh, you know, no, I don't. I'll work it out. I'll, you know, finesse people or whatever. No, they were right. if you can't get on board with what we're trying to do and believe in it, then you got to go. And I didn't make friends that way. I will promise you that. I did not make friends that way.
And, wow. Which is probably why you probably weren't there to make friends. I have to ask this question. Paul, you ran a successful charter school, Green Tech, in Albany. And I'm just wondering, can you parallel some of the things that Sarah went through at Discovery, or any diverging things? How were you successful there at Green Tech?
Well, it was very similar. So I remember I got there and I got to Green Tech, and the graduation rate was about 57%. I think also they said that a month in, they said, oh, you're not going to meet payroll financially, about $90,000 short. And so I had to figure it out. And so initially when I got there, people weren't really too excited about needing to do something different to get to where we had to go. And so the previous leader, very good. And when I say very good, he built something and a phenomenal culture. He built something that was special or different for the community, but they weren't moving the needle the way they needed to academically. So when I came in, I came in rather like rowdy and boisterous, like, nah, this, we got to change. We're going to have to do whatever we got to do. And if you don't like it, get down or lay down, like that type of attitude, like you can get some going. And so that didn't go over real well. Now, I still always meant that, right? But I realized I had to approach it differently, and I had to realize that I had to get buy-in differently, and I realized that the teachers were the heartbeat of my school, and that because they were the heartbeat, I had to treat them as the heartbeat. And I had to, and you can have other organs that aren't working, but as long as your heart's working, you're still alive. So I had to get their buy-in, and once I got their buy-in, we were able to change. Like, we were able to move it, but we did have to. We have to put other things in place culturally to move the needle. We had to put things in place academically and put the structures and structures and structure in place academically. We had to financially put things in place. So like when I left, there was a 95, we averaged for 11 years a 95% graduation rate, 100% acceptance to college, and millions of dollars scholarship money every year, and we had 1.8 million in the bank. So we had to put those systems and structures, but people didn't like change. But it was also my approach as a leader to approach it in a way that I got them to buy into it and believe in it and then run through walls to get to the changes.
How long did it take for you to get the first wave of good change?
So that was interesting. So initially they weren't trying to hear me. And then I walked in during a review year. And so SUNY was our reviewer, our authorizer. And so SUNY came in and told them the same things that I did. And they were like, oh, crap. Like, if SUNY's saying it, oh, now we're going to believe him. So then I had an easier time now getting them to shift because there was somebody else that said the same thing that I was saying it. But now it became like, hey, if you guys don't do something different, your guys aren't going to have jobs. The school's not going to be open. And so we went from, and this was when I first walked in the doors, they gave us a 3-year renewal, and I had only been there for 2 or 3 months, we're trying to figure it out, to having nothing less than 5-year renewals because we were able to change things. So that year started to shift, started to weed some people out that really weren't there for the work and that were their egos were too driven to roll their sleeves up and do what they had to do. And then we were able to push forward and move that needle.
So the reason I asked that, Sarah, is this, and I wanted your thoughts on this. Some say, and it may be true there, that there are little things that can go on over time, but major change normally happens rapidly. That if it doesn't happen in a few years, it may not happen because culturally it's just not there. So right. What do you think there? Do you think that if you're going to really move the needle, if you're going to really engage in major structural change and organizational change that will ultimately reflect some great scholarly change, do you believe that must be done quickly, or do you think slow and steady she goes?
I think quickly. Mm-hmm. I think slow and steady is just going to get you slow and steady back to where you were.
Wow.
I mean, it. I had a lot of the same experiences, for sure. I had to get to the heart of the school, and the heart of the school was the teachers, like you said. And the one thing we could all agree on was we love the kids. That's the one thing we could all agree on. And one of my first staff meetings, talking about, you know, turnaround, and we're in a turnaround year, and what does this mean, and what kind of urgency do we have to have? I did something that I think bothered some people, but also moved some people. I printed out 8x10 photos of each of our 6th graders, posted them up on a big board. Everybody loved those kids. They had known whether they taught them in kindergarten or 2nd grade or a couple times over because they were their sped teachers. And I just, you know, put that visual there. If we continue to do what we're doing, this is the future of these students. These students will graduate. And the kids who weren't ready to leave us, I took a big black marker and I X'd out their picture. And we were left with 3 kids out of a whole cohort of kids. And people didn't like that I was X'ing out those kids' faces, but that's what we're doing. We weren't setting them up for success. They're going to get to seventh grade. They can't read. They can't do math. You know, statistics say they're going to drop out, or they're going to be subject to some violence, or, you know, they're going to end up in jail, or they're definitely not going to graduate, or they're going to be having babies next year. So I think really helping people see the change that's necessary is essential.
So people think oftentimes when they hear of the success of Sarah, the success of Paul, and how quickly a lot of things change, that, you know what, just bring in a good leader, just have a good curriculum, just have some great people around you, and things will just fall into place. Tell me about what kept you up at night and how difficult it was and the drudgery of what it takes if you're serious about change.
Oof. Well, I was up a lot of nights. It takes a lot. So I can't pinpoint one thing, but definitely, you know, I was up at night. Am I going to have the right teachers that my kids deserve? Are we going to be able to prepare the teachers? Maybe we have certified teachers, but they weren't prepared to teach my students. Mm. Am I going to be able to prioritize my time around teaching and learning, or am I going to get pulled in 10 different directions? Around finances or HR needs or ordering lunches or, you know, ordering mulch for the playground. I couldn't do those things. I needed to really delegate and set up a structure for myself as a leader to be a true instructional leader. And then as I started doing that, I got a little bit more sleep. but then, you know, the tests start, you know, the tests get closer, and then you set these targets and you have a plan for the target to reach those targets with kids. And then what if we don't reach those targets? And what if we do reach those targets? Because then we have to keep doing better and better and better. And I think that's where I'm at now. Wow. What I mean, we will reach those targets. I can't wait for those test scores. But then it panics me, because now I know we could do it. Now we need to continue to do it. You need to sustain. And it's not easy. It's a lot of schools say the right things. They say they're doing the right things. Well, yeah, I'm doing that. I have targets. I have this. I have that. But are you really doing it? You can have targets, but if you don't have a plan to reach them, then you just have dreams, right? Like, that's what we had before. We just had dreams. Our previous director, who I love him. I thought he was a great human being. He set up a great structure, like Paul had said, his previous leader. But we had these targets and goals, but no plans to get there. And the plans are hard.
And that's what I think. I think with leadership and successful leaders, it's especially in this world, in this educational world, it's not really a 9-to-5 job. So mm-hmm. It's something that you kind of eat, breathe, and sleep thinking about, and that you're consistently working to implement and do something different. And so if something's not working, then you work towards doing something differently or change it. You don't wait for a long time for it to fail or for it to keep failing. And you don't just change to change, but you change because you need to do something different. And I think that's why a lot of schools end up stuck, is because they're not being progressive, because they're worried about somebody's feelings, or they're worried about a contract, or they're worried about what someone will or won't say, or is it comfortable for adults? But if it's not working, why do you keep doing it? So my next thought to you is, why aren't other struggling schools following your formula for change?
Well, first, I don't know if they know what we're doing. You know, and I would say fortunately and unfortunately, the way charter schools in Rochester, New York, and I think in New York in general are set up, we're set up to be our own individual districts, our own buildings, and we're all competitive. We all want to be the best. So, I mean, my door is always open. I welcome in critical friends. I'm happy to go to other schools, but a lot of people, you know, don't want to share or don't want to hear what we're doing because it's so competitive.
Sarah's being so nice about
this. I know, I'm trying.
She's being so nice. But you know what happens? We actually have this conspiracy thing that goes on, that, you know what, you don't really have 71%. What you did is you told all the students who couldn't cut it to stay home and don't get tested. And so you manipulated the system so that 71 really isn't 71. And you know what? You had a secret donor who gave you millions of dollars. And they you're able to have 27 coaches in every single classroom. So, of course, you can do it that way. No one wants to just say, let me listen to what works.
Right.
And see if we can learn, because ultimately it is not about me.
It's about the kids.
It's about the kids. I'm not sure what it's going to take to get that. But let me ask this question. I want both Sarah and Paul to answer this. When you look at where we are with the state of teachers and the need for quality teachers in the classroom. Now, I don't want the answer about what the educational background must be, or what their licensing status would be and their certification status, not that, but the intangibles. When you sit across the room and you're trying to figure out whether this is a person that could teach my kids, what does that person look like to you?
So to me and for me, we're, you know what, they may not always have the educational background that we're looking for at these days and times, but I'm looking for resilience and grit. So great. I would tell all teachers, when they came to me, I would say to them, this is going to be the hardest job you've ever had. There's no doubt about it. I don't know where you've worked, where you've taught it before, if you have or haven't, whatever you're doing, this will, because guess what? There's always going to be something extra here. It's never going to be enough. You're always going to have to do something extra. There's always going to be one more thing. And the people that I would want to hire were people that were sincerely okay with one more thing. They were sincerely okay that good isn't good enough, that one more thing had to be done. So if 10 people called out, you might have to cover an extra class. I might have to cover class. We might have to do whatever we have to do. If, you know, you might have to teach extra. You might have to, if I had to go plunge a toilet, I was going to go plunge a toilet. Whatever I had to do is what I'm going to have to do. And there's always going to be something, one more thing for kids. So that person that was willing to do one more thing was invaluable to me versus somebody who had the right scholarly background, because, you know, if you could do one more thing, you could be trained on how to do the other things.
I would agree with that completely. I would also, I always say in an interview, how do you feel about feedback? I say to people, listen, every day you're teaching, myself or one of the leadership team members is going to be in your room. So I need people to be okay with feedback. I need to hear how they receive feedback, what kind of communication they're comfortable with. Can they connect with people? I think for elementary teachers especially, you're an entertainer. You need to be engaging.
I had heard that one. Okay. Yeah.
You need to be engaging. You need to connect with people. You need to be able to build relationships. You need to be able to collaborate with people. You need to be able to communicate. And if you can do those things, if you can take feedback and you can communicate and you can engage, you'll be okay. I'm, like I said before when we were off air, one of my best teachers is not certified, but she's incredible. She's just got it. Some people just have it.
I really appreciate that, Sarah. It's been amazing talking to you. It's been amazing thinking about the work that Discovery does. You know, I really walk around with this thought in my mind, Dr. Miller, that if one person has done it, then it's possible and someone else can do it. Discovery's done it. I know Green Tech's done it. A number of schools have done it. This is not impossible. I think there's some things that we could do. And Dr. Miller, will you close us out and give us those things?
Right, so a good school is there's a foundation, and every school has a foundation. And so then there has to be some rituals and routines around those foundations. So adamantly believe that the first and foremost when you're educating black and brown kids is about building relationships. But then the school leader needs to put systems in to build relationships. And what does that look like? The relationships between leadership and staff, staff and students, leadership and students, leadership and parents, parents and community, and all of these relationships. And there has to be purposeful conversations to build these relationships. The second piece is, what does good teaching and learning look like? And so there has to be structures and systems in for good teaching and learning, and you have to follow those, whether or not you want to. You can't use your same lesson plans from 1964 and think that it's going to work for today. You have to be able to change, adjust, and you have to work towards planning towards success, but there has to be rituals, routines, and I definitely believe in structure across the board for instruction to make sure that we're seeing some normalcy and consistency in classrooms. Third thing is, how do we use data to inform instructional conversations, and which data is the most important to look at, and which data is going to help us become better at what we're doing, but actually doing it? Because a lot of schools have data, but they're not using it, or they're using the wrong data. So if it's not moving the conversation, something needs to happen. And the last piece is accountability. So how do we hold everybody accountable? How do we hold ourselves accountable? How do we hold staff accountable? How do we hold students accountable? How do we hold parents accountable? And that accountability, so those four pillars, and making sure that underneath those four pillars that you can have success. And so if you think about it, that's what Sarah has done. That's what I did. All those pieces are within building a successful school, and it can be duplicated. You just got to be willing to move that needle, and you got to be willing to do the work. And so, again, last week we threw out a challenge to the Rochester City School District. Reverend Johnson and I said, we will come in and take your lowest performing school and do it for free and help them move the needle and change that, as long as the leader's willing and that the political bureaucracy is willing. As long as that's willing and able, let's do it. Let's get it. Let's change. Because, again, it's about our kids and our babies. So if you want to move the needle, I hope Sarah said some things that resonates with you. Hope I said some things. I hope Reverend Johnson said some things. Hey, we're going to move the needle. And until next time, we'll see you later.
Thanks for listening to this podcast on the WDKX Podcast Network.
Provided by Vision Automotive.